held them tightly between her own. Try to remember that. And the only way anything ever gets done is when you make up your mind to do it. I know a lot of our loved ones, a lot of our men, have died in prison. But not all of them. You remember that. And you ain't really alone in that bed, Tish. You got that child beneath your heart, and we're all counting on you. Fonny's counting on you to bring that child here safe and well. You're the only one who can do it. But you're strong. Lean on your strength. I said, yes. Yes, Mama. I knew I didn't have any strength. But I was going to have to find some. Somewhere. Are you all right now? Can you sleep? Yes. I don't want to sound foolish, but just remember, love brought you here. If you trusted love this far, don't panic now. And again, she kissed me, and she turned out the light, and she left me. I lay there, wide awake, and very frightened. Get me out of here. I remembered women I had known but scarcely looked at who had frightened me, because they knew how to use their bodies in order to get something that they wanted. I now began to realize that my judgment of these women had had very little to do with morals, and I now began to wonder about the meaning of this word. My judgment had been due to my sense of how little they appeared to want. I could not conceive of peddling myself for so low a price. But for a higher price? For Fonny? And I fell asleep for a while, and then I woke up. I had never been so tired in my life. I ached all over. I looked at the clock and I realized that it would soon be time to get up and go to work unless I called in sick. But I could not call in sick. I got dressed and went out to the kitchen to have tea with Mama. Joseph and Ernestine had already gone. Mama and I sipped our tea in almost total silence. Something was turning over and over and over in my mind. I could not speak. I came down into the streets. It was a little past 8 o'clock. I walked these morning streets. These streets are never empty. I passed the old blind black man on the corner. Perhaps I had seen him all my life, but I wondered about his life for the first time now. There were about 4 kids, all junkies, standing on the corner talking. Some women were rushing to work. I tried to read their faces. Some women were finally going to get a little rest, and they headed off the avenue to their furnished rooms. Every side street was piled high with garbage, and garbage was piled high before every stoop along the avenue. I thought, if I'm going to peddle ass, I better not try it up here. It would take just as long as scrubbing floors and be a lot more painful. What I was really thinking was, I know I can't do it before the baby comes, but if Fonny's not out by then, maybe I'll have to try it. Maybe I better get ready. But there was something else turning over at the bottom of my mind, which I knew I didn't have the courage to look at yet. Get ready. How? I walked down the steps and pushed through the turnstile and stood on the subway platform with the others. When the train came, I pushed in with the others, and I leaned against a pole while their breath and smell rolled over me. Cold sweat covered my forehead and began to trickle down my armpits and my back. I hadn't thought of it before because I knew I had to keep on working up to just about the last minute, but now I began to wonder just how. As I became heavier and sicker, I was going to get to work. If I should pass out, these people, getting on and getting off, would simply trample me and the baby to death. We're counting on you. Fonny's counting on you. Fonny's counting on you to bring that baby here safe and well. I held the white bar more firmly. My freezing body shook. I looked around the subway car. It was a little like the drawings I had seen of slave ships. Of course, they hadn't had newspapers on the slave ships, hadn't needed them yet. But as concerned space, and also perhaps as concerned intention, the principle was exactly the same. A heavy man, smelling of hot sauce and toothpaste, breathed heavily into my face. It wasn't his fault that he had to breathe or that my face was there. His body pressed against me, too, very hard. But this did not mean that he was thinking of rape or thinking of me at all. He was probably wondering only, and that dimly, how he was going to get through another day on his job. And he certainly did not see me. And when a subway car is packed, unless it's full of people who know each other, going on a picnic, say, it is almost always silent. It's as though everybody is just holding his breath, waiting to get out of there. Each time the train comes into a station and some of the people push you aside in order to get out, as happened now, for example, with the man who smelled of hot sauce and toothpaste, a great sigh seems to rise, stifled immediately by the people who get on. Now, a blonde girl, carrying a bandbox, was breathing her hangover into my face. My stop came and I got off, climbed the steps and crossed the street. I went into the service entrance and punched the clock, put my street clothes away, and went out to my counter. I was a little late for the floor, but I'd clocked in on time. The floor manager, a white boy, young, nice enough, gave me a mock scowl as I hurried to my place. It isn't only old white ladies who come to that counter to smell the back of my hand. Very rarely does a black cat come anywhere near this counter, and if or when he does, his intentions are often more generous and always more precise. Perhaps for a black cat, I really do too closely resemble a helpless baby sister. He doesn't want to see me turn into a whore. And perhaps some black cats come closer just to look into my eyes, just to hear my voice, to check out what's happening. And they never smell the back of my hand. A black cat puts out his hand, and you spray it. And he carries the back of his own hand to his own nostrils, and he doesn't bother to pretend that he's come to buy perfume. Sometimes he does buy some perfume. Most often, he doesn't. Sometimes the hand he has brought down from his nostrils clenches itself into a secret fist. And with that prayer, that salutation, he moves away. But a white man will carry your hand to his nostrils. He will hold it there. I watched everybody all day long with something turning over and over and over in my mind. Ernestine came to pick me up at the end of the day. She said that Mrs. Rogers had been located in Santurce, Puerto Rico, and some one of us would have to go there. With Hayward? No. Hayward's got to deal with Bell and the DA here. Anyway, you can see that for many, many reasons, Hayward can't go. He'd be accused of intimidating a witness.
But that's what they're doing.
Tish, we were walking up 8th Avenue toward Columbus Circle. It would take us until your baby is voting age to prove that. Are we going to take the subway or the bus? We're going to sit down somewhere until this rush hour's over. You and me, we've got to talk anyway, before we talk to Mama and Daddy. They don't know yet. I haven't talked to them yet. and I realize how much Ernestine loves me. At the same time that I remember that she is, after all, only 4 years older than I. Mrs. Victoria Rogers, née Victoria Maria San Felipe Sanchez, declares that on the evening of March 5th, between the hours of 11 and 12, in the vestibule of her home, she was criminally assaulted by a man she now knows to have been Alonzo Hunt, and was used by the aforesaid Hunt in the most extreme and abominable sexual manner, and forced to undergo the most unimaginable sexual perversions. I have never seen her. I know only that an American-born Irishman, Gary Rogers, an engineer, went to Puerto Rico about 6 years ago and there met Victoria, who was then about 18. He married her and brought her to the mainland. His career did not go up, but down. He seems to have become embittered. In any case, having pumped 3 children out of her, he left. I know nothing about the man with whom she was living on Orchard Street, with whom, presumably, she had fled to Puerto Rico. The children are, presumably, somewhere on the mainland with her relatives. Her home is Orchard Street. She lived on the 4th floor. If the rape took place in the vestibule, then she was raped on the ground floor under the staircase. It could have taken place on the 4th floor, but it seems unlikely. There are 4 apartments on that floor. Orchard Street, if you know New York, is a very long way from Bank Street. Orchard Street is damn near in the East River, and Bank Street is practically in the Hudson. It is not possible to run from Orchard to Bank, particularly not with the police behind you. Yet Bell swears that he saw Fonny run from the scene of the crime. This is possible only if Bell were off duty, for his beat is on the west side, not the east. Yet Bell could arrest Fonny out of the house on Bank Street. It is then up to the accused to prove and pay for proving the irregularity and improbability of this sequence of events. Ernestine and I had sat down in the last booth of a bar off Columbus. Ernestine's way with me, and with all her children, is to drop something heavy on you and then lean back, calculating how you'll take it. She's got to know that in order to calculate her own position, the nets got to be in place. Now, maybe because I had spent so much of the day and the night before with my terrors and my calculations concerning the possible sale of my body, I began to see the reality of rape. I asked, "Do you think she really was raped?" "Tish, I don't know what's going on in that busy, ingrown mind of yours, but that question has no bearing on anything. As far as our situation is concerned, baby, she was raped. That's it." She paused and sipped her drink. She sounded very calm, but her forehead was tense, intelligent with terror. "I think, in fact, that she was raped, and that she has absolutely no idea who did it. Would probably not even recognize him if he passed her on the street. I may sound crazy, but the mind works that way. She'd recognize him if he raped her again, but then it would no longer be rape, if you see what I mean."
"I see what you mean, but why does she accuse Fonny?"
"Because Fonny was presented to her as the rapist, and it was much easier to say yes than to try and relive the whole damn thing again. This way, it's over for her, except for the trial, but then it's really over for her."
"And for us too?"
"No."
She looked at me very steadily. It may seem a funny thing to say, but I found myself admiring her guts. "It won't be over for us." She spoke very carefully, watching me all the while. "There's a way in which it may never be over for us, but we won't talk about that now. Listen, we have to think about it very seriously, and in another way. That's why I wanted to have a drink alone with you,
before we went home.
What are you trying to tell me?
I was suddenly very frightened. Listen, I don't think we can get her to change her testimony. You've got to understand. She's not lying.
What are you trying to tell me? What the fuck do you mean she's not lying?
Will you listen to me, please? Of course she's lying. We know she's lying. But she's not lying. As far as she's concerned, Fonny raped her, and that's that. And now she hasn't got to deal with it anymore. It's over for her. If she changes her testimony, she'll go mad or become another woman. And you know how often people go mad and how rarely they change.
So, what are we to do?
We have to disprove the state's case. There's no point in saying that we have to make them prove it. Because as far as they're concerned, the accusation is the proof. And that's exactly the way those nuts in the jury box will take it, quiet as it's kept. They're liars, too. And we know they're liars. But they don't.
I remembered, for some reason, something someone had said to me a long time ago. It might have been Fonny. A fool never says he's a fool.
We can't disprove it. Daniel's in jail.
Yes. But Hayward is seeing him tomorrow.
That don't mean nothing. Daniel is still going to change his testimony, I bet you.
He may not. But I have another idea.
There we sat, in this dirty bar, two sisters, trying to be cool.
Let's say the worst comes to the worst. Mrs. Rogers will not change her testimony. Let's say Daniel changes his. That leaves only Officer Bell, doesn't it?
Yes. And so what?
Well, I have a file on him. A long file. I can prove that he murdered a 12-year-old black boy in Brooklyn 2 years ago. That's how come he was transferred to Manhattan. I know the mother of the murdered boy. And I know Belle's wife, who hates him.
She can't testify against him.
She hasn't got to testify against him. She just has to sit in that courtroom and watch him.
I don't see how this helps us at all.
I know you don't, and you may be right. But if worst comes to worst, and it's always better to assume that it will come to worst, then our tactic has to be to shatter the credibility of the state's only witness.
Ernestine, I said, you're dreaming.
I don't think I am. I'm gambling. If I can get those two women, one white and one black, to sit in that courtroom, and if Hayward does his work right, we ought to be able to shatter the case on cross-examination. Remember, Tish, that after all, it isn't very much of a case. If Fonny were white, it wouldn't be a case at all.
Well, I understand what she means. I know where she's coming from. It's a long shot, but in our position, after all, only the long shot counts. We don't have any other. That's it. And I realize, too, that if we thought it were feasible, we might very well be sitting here, cool, very cool, discussing ways and means of having Belle's head blown off. And when it was done, we'd shrug and have another drink. That's it. People don't know.
Yes. Okay. What about Puerto Rico?
That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you before we talk to Mama and Daddy. Look, you can't go. You've got to be here. For one thing, without you, Fonny will panic. I don't see how I can go. I've got to keep lighting firecrackers under Hayward's ass. Obviously, a man can't go, Daddy can't go, and God knows Frank can't go. That leaves Mama.
Mama?
Yes.
She don't want to go to Puerto Rico?
That's right. And she hates planes. but she wants your baby's father out of jail. Of course she doesn't want to go to Puerto Rico, but she'll go.
And what do you think she can do?
She can do something no special investigator can do. She may be able to break through to Mrs. Rogers. Maybe not, but if she can, we're ahead. And if not, well, we haven't lost anything. And at least we'll know we've tried.
I watch her forehead. Okay.
And what about Daniel? I told you Hayward is seeing him tomorrow. He may have been able to see him today. He's calling us tonight.
I lean back. Some shit.
Yeah, but we in it now.
Then we are silent. I realize for the first time that the bar is loud. And I look around me. It's actually a terrible place. And I realize that the people here can only suppose that Ernestine and I are tired whores. Or a lesbian couple, or both.
Well,
we are certainly in it now. And it may get worse.
It will, certainly.
And now something almost as hard to catch as a whisper in a crowded place, as light and as definite as a spider's web, strikes below my ribs. Stunning. And astonishing my heart. Get worse. But that light tap, that kick, that signal, announces to me that what can get worse can get better. Yes, it will get worse. But the baby, turning for the first time in its incredible veil of water, announces its presence and claims me. Tells me in that instant that what can get worse can get better. And that what can get better can get worse. In the meantime, forever, it is entirely up to me. The baby cannot get here without me. And while I may have known this in one way a little while ago, now, the baby knows it and tells me that while it will certainly be worse once it leaves the water, what gets worse can also get better. It will be in the water for a while yet, but it is preparing itself for a transformation, and so must I. I said, "It's all right. I'm not afraid." And Ernestine smiled and said, "Let's move it then." Joseph and Frank, as we learn later, have also been sitting in a bar. And this is what happened between them. Joseph has a certain advantage over Frank, though it is only now that he begins to realize, or rather suspect it, in that he has no sons. He has always wanted a son. This fact cost Ernestine far more than it cost me, for by the time I came along, he was reconciled. If he had had sons, they might very well be dead or in jail. And they both know, facing each other in the booth of a bar on Lenox Avenue, that it is a miracle that Joseph's daughters are not on the block. Both of them know far more than either of them would like to know, and certainly far more than either can say concerning the disasters which have overtaken the women in Frank's house. And Frank looks down, holding his drink tightly between both hands. He has a son. And Joseph sips his beer and watches him. That son is also his son now. And that makes Frank his brother. They are both grown men approaching 50, and they are both in terrible trouble. Neither of them look it. Joseph is much darker than Frank. Black, deep-set hooded eyes, stern, still, a high forehead in which one vein beats, leftward. A forehead so high that it can make you think of cathedrals.
His lips are always a little twisted. Only those who know him, only those who love him, know when this twist signals laughter, love, or fury. The key is to be found in the pulsing vein in the forehead. The lips change very little. The eyes change all the time. And when Joseph is happy and when he laughs, something absolutely miraculous is happening. He then looks, I swear to you, and his hair is beginning to turn gray, about 13 years old. I thought once, I'm certainly glad I didn't meet him when he was a young man. And then I thought, but you're his daughter. And then I dropped into a paralyzed silence thinking, wow. Frank is light, thinner. I don't think that you can describe my father as handsome, but you can describe Frank that way. I don't mean to be putting him down when I say that because that face has paid and is paying a dreadful price. People make you pay for the way you look, which is also the way you think you look. And what time writes in a human face is the record of that collision. Frank has survived it, barely. His forehead is lined like the palm of a hand, unreadable. His graying hair is thick and curls violently upward from the widow's peak. His lips are not as thick as Joseph's and do not dance that way, are pressed tightly together, as though he wished they would disappear. His cheekbones are high, and his large, dark eyes slant upward, like Fonny's. Fonny has his father's eyes. Joseph certainly cannot realize this in the way that his daughter knows it, but he stares at Frank in silence and forces Frank to raise his eyes.
What we gonna do?
Frank asks.
Well, the first thing we got to do,
says Joseph resolutely,
is to stop blaming each other and stop blaming ourselves. If we can't do that, man, we'll never get the boy out because we'll be so fucked up. And we cannot fuck up now, baby, and I know you hear where I'm coming from.
Man, what? Asks Frank with his little smile. We gonna do about the money?
You ever have any money?
Joseph asks. Frank looks up at him and says nothing, merely questions him with his eyes. Joseph asks again,
you ever have any money?
Frank says, finally,
no.
Then why are you worried about it now?
Frank looks up at him again.
You raised them somehow, didn't you? You fed them somehow, didn't you? If we start to worry about money now, man, we're gonna be fucked, and we're gonna lose our children. That white man, baby, and may his balls shrivel and his asshole rot, he wants you to be worried about the money. That's his whole game. But if we got to where we are without money, we can get further. I ain't worried about they money. They ain't got no right to it anyhow. They stole it from us. They ain't never met nobody they didn't lie to and steal from. Well, I can steal too and rob. How you think I raised my daughters? Shit.
But Frank is not Joseph. He stares down again into his drink.
What you think is gonna happen?
What we make happen,
says Joseph, again with resolution.
That's easy to say,
says Frank.
Not if you mean it,
says Joseph. There is a long silence into which neither man speaks. Even the jukebox is silent.
I guess, Frank says finally, I love Fonny more than I love anybody in this world. And it makes me ashamed, man. I swear, because he was a real sweet, manly little boy. Wasn't scared of nothing, except maybe his mama. He didn't understand his mama.
Frank stops.
And I don't know what I should have done.
I ain't a woman. And there's some things only a woman can do with a child, and I thought she loved him. Like I guess I thought one time she loved me.
Frank sips his drink and he tries to smile.
I don't know if I was ever any kind of father to him. Any kind of real father. And now he's in jail and it ain't his fault and I don't even know how I'm gonna get him out. I'm sure one hell of a man.
Well, says Joseph, he sure think you are. He loves you. And he respects you now. You got to remember that I might know that much better than you. Tell you something else. Your baby son is the father of my baby daughter's baby. Now, how you gonna sit here and act like can't nothing be done? We got a child on the way here, man. You want me to beat the shit out of you?
He says this with ferocity, but after a moment, he smiles.
I know, he says then carefully. I know. But I know some hustles, and you know some hustles, and these are our children, and we got to set them free.
Joseph finishes his beer.
So let's drink up, man, and go on in. We got a whole lot of shit to deal with, in a hurry.
Frank finishes his drink and straightens his shoulders.
You're right, old buddy. Let's make it.
The date for Fonny's trial keeps changing. This fact, paradoxically, forces me to realize that Haywood's concern is genuine. I don't think that he very much cared in the beginning. He had never taken a case like Fonny's before, and it was Ernestine, acting partly out of experience but mainly out of instinct, who had bludgeoned him into it. But once into it, the odor of shit rose high, and he had no choice but to keep on stirring it. It became obvious at once, for example, that the degree of his concern for his client, or the fact that he had any genuine concern for his client at all, placed him at odds, at loggerheads, with the keepers of the keys and seals. He had not expected this, and at first it bewildered, then frightened, then angered him. He swiftly understood that he was between the carrot and the stick. He couldn't avoid the stick, but he had to make it clear, finally, that he'd be damned if he'd go for the carrot. This had the effect of isolating, indeed, of branding him. And as this increased Fonny's danger, it also increased Hayward's responsibility. It did not help that I distrusted him. Ernestine harangued him. Mama was laconic, and for Joseph, he was just another white boy with a college degree. Although, naturally, in the beginning I distrusted him, I am not really what you can call a distrustful person. And anyway, as time wore on, with each of us trying to hide our terror from the other, we began to depend more and more on one another. We had no choice. And I began to see as time wore on that for Hayward, the battle increasingly became a private one, involving neither gratitude nor public honor. It was a sordid, banal case, this rape by a black boy of an ignorant Puerto Rican woman. What was he getting so excited about? And so his colleagues scorned and avoided him. This fact introduced yet other dangers. Not least of them, the danger of retreating into the self-pitying and quixotic. But Fonny was too real a presence, and Hayward too proud a man for that. But the calendars were full. It would take about 1,000 years to try all the people in the American prisons, but the Americans are optimistic and still hope for time, and sympathetic or merely intelligent judges are as rare as snowstorms in the tropics. There was the obscene power and the ferocious enmity of the DA's office. Thus, Hayward walked a chalk line, maneuvering very hard to bring Fonny before a judge who would really listen to the case.
For this, Haywood needed charm, patience, money, and a backbone of tempered steel. He managed to see Daniel, who has been beaten. He cannot arrange for his release because Daniel has been booked on a narcotics charge. Without becoming Daniel's lawyer, he cannot visit him. He suggests this to Daniel, but Daniel is evasive and afraid. Haywood suspects that Daniel has also been drugged, and he does not know if he dares bring Daniel to the witness stand or not. So, there we are. Mama begins letting out my clothes, and I go to work wearing jackets and slacks. But it's clear that I'm not going to be able to keep working much longer. I've got to be able to visit Fonny every instant that I can. Joseph is working overtime, double time, and so is Frank. Ernestine has to spend less time with her children because she has taken a job as part-time private secretary to a very rich and eccentric young actress whose connections she intends to intimidate and use. Joseph is coldly, systematically, stealing from the docks. And Frank is stealing from the garment center, and they sell the hot goods in Harlem or in Brooklyn. They don't tell us this, but we know it. They don't tell us because if things go wrong, we can't be accused of being accomplices. We cannot penetrate their silence. We must not try. Each of these men would gladly go to jail, blow away a pig, or blow up a city to save their progeny from the jaws of this democratic hell. Now, Sharon must begin preparing for her Puerto Rican journey, and Haywood briefs her.
She is not actually in Santurce, but a little beyond it in what might once have been called a suburb, but which is now far worse than what we would call a slum. In Puerto Rico, I believe it is called a favela. I have been to Puerto Rico once, and so I will not try to describe a favela. And I am sure when you return that you will not try to describe it either.
Haywood looks at her, at once distant and intense, and hands her a typewritten sheet of paper.
This is the address, but I think that you will understand almost as soon as you get where you're going that the word address has almost no meaning. It would be more honest to say this is the neighborhood.
Sharon, wearing her floppy beige beret, looks at it.
There's no phone, says Haywood, and anyway, a phone is the very last thing you need. You might as well send up flares. But it isn't hard to find. Just follow your nose.
They stare at each other.
Now, says Haywood with his really painful smile, just to make things easier for you, I must tell you that we are not really certain under which name she is living. Her maiden name is Sanchez. But that's a little like looking for a Mrs. Jones or a Mr. Smith. Her married name is Rogers, but I am sure that that appears only on her passport. The name of what we must call her common law husband.
And now he pauses to look down at another sheet of paper, and then at Sharon, and then at me,
is Pietro Tomasino Alvarez.
He hands Sharon this piece of paper, and again Sharon studies it.
And, says Haywood, take this with you. I hope it will help. She still looks this way. It was snapped last week.
And he hands Sharon a photograph, slightly larger than passport size. I have never seen her. I stand to peer over Sharon's shoulder. She is blonde. But are Puerto Ricans blonde? She is smiling up into the camera, a constipated smile. Yet, there is life in the eyes. The eyes and the eyebrows are dark, and the dark shoulders are bare. This from a nightclub? Sharon asks, and Yes, Hayward answers. She watching him, he watching her, and...
Does she work there?
Sharon asks.
No, says Hayward, but Pietro does.
I keep studying over my mother's shoulder the face of my most mortal enemy. Mama turns the photograph over and holds it in her lap.
And how old is this Pietro?
About 22, says Hayward.
And just exactly like as the song puts it, God arose in a windstorm, and he troubled everybody's mind. Silence fell in the office. Mama leans forward, thinking ahead.
22.
She says slowly.
Yes, says Hayward. I'm afraid that detail may present us with a brand new ball game.
What do you want me to do exactly?
Sharon asks.
Help me, Hayward says.
Well, says Sharon after a moment, opening her purse, then opening her wallet, carefully placing the bits of paper in her wallet, closing the wallet, burying the wallet in the depths of her purse, and snapping shut the purse.
Then I'll be leaving sometime tomorrow. I'll call, or have somebody call before I go, just so you'll know where I am.
And she rises, and Hayward rises, and we walk to the door.
Do you have a photograph of Fanny with you?
Hayward asks.
I do, I say. And I open my bag and find my wallet. I actually have two photographs, one of Fanny and me leaning against the railing of the house on Bank Street. His shirt is open to the belly button. He has one arm around me, and we are both laughing. The other is of Fanny alone, sitting in the house near the record player, somber and peaceful. And it's my favorite photograph of him. Mama takes the photographs, hands them to Hayward, who studies them. Then she takes them back from Hayward.
These the only ones you got? She asks me.
Yes, I say.
She hands me back the photograph of Fanny alone. She puts the one of Fanny and me into her wallet, which again descends into the bottom of her purse.
This one ought to get it, she says. After all, it is my daughter, and she ain't been raped.
She shakes hands with Hayward.
Keep your fingers crossed, son, and let's hope the old lady can bring home the goods.
She turns toward the door. But Hayward checks her again.
The fact that you are going to Puerto Rico makes me feel better than I have felt for weeks. But I must also tell you that the DA's office is in constant touch with the Hunt family, that is, the mother and the two sisters. And their position appears to be that Fanny has always been incorrigible and worthless.
Hayward pauses and looks steadily at us both.
Now, if the state can get three respectable black women to depose or to testify that their son and brother has always been a dangerously antisocial creature, this is a very serious blow for us.
He pauses again, and he turns toward the window.
As a matter of fact, for Galileo Santini is not a stupid man. It might be vastly more effective if he does not call them as character witnesses, for then they cannot be cross-examined. He need merely convey to the jury that these respectable church-going women are prostrate with shame and grief, and the father can be dismissed as a hard-drinking good-for-nothing, a dreadful example to his son, especially as he has publicly threatened to blow Santini's head off.
He turns from the window to watch us very carefully.
I think I will probably call on you, Sharon, and on Mr. Rivers as character witnesses. But you see what we are up against.
It's always better, says Sharon, to know than not to know.
Hayward claps Sharon gently on the shoulder.
So try to bring home the goods.
I think to myself, and I will take care of those sisters and that mother. But I don't say anything except, thanks, Hayward. Goodbye.
And Sharon says, okay, got you. Goodbye.
And we walk down the hall to the elevator. I remember the night the baby was conceived, because it was the night of the day we finally found our loft. And this cat, whose name was Levy, really was going to rent it to us. He wasn't full of shit. He was an olive-skinned, curly-haired, merry-faced boy from the Bronx, about 33 maybe, with big, kind of electrical black eyes. And he dug us. He dug people who loved each other. The loft was off Canal Street, and it was big and in pretty good condition. It had two big windows on the street, and the two back windows opened onto a roof with a railing. There was a room for Fonny to work, and with all the windows open, you wouldn't die of heat prostration in the summertime. We were very excited about the roof because you could have dinner on it, or serve drinks, or just sit there in the evenings if you wanted to, with your arms around each other.
Hell, Levy said, drag out the blankets and sleep on it.
He smiled at Fonny.
Make babies on it. That's how I got here.
What I most remember about him is that he didn't make either of us feel self-conscious. We all laughed together.
You two should have some beautiful babies, he said. And take it from me, kids. The world damn sure needs them.
He asked us for only 1 month in advance, and about a week later, I took the money over to him. And then, when Fonny got into trouble, he did something very strange, and I think very beautiful. He called me and he said that I could have the money back anytime I wanted it. But he said he wouldn't rent that loft to anybody but us.
I can't, he said. The bastards. That loft stays empty until your man gets out of jail. And I ain't just whistling Dixie, honey.
And he gave me his number and asked me please to let him know if there was anything at all he could do.
I want you kids to have your babies. I'm funny that way.
Levy explained and exhibited the somewhat complicated structure of locks and keys. Our loft was the top, up 3 or 4 stories. The stairs were steep. There was a set of keys for our loft, which had double locks. Then there was the door at the top of the steps, which locked us away from the rest of the building.
Man, Fonny asked, what do we do in case of fire? Oh, said Levy, I forgot.
And he unlocked the doors again and we went back into the loft. He took us onto the roof and led us to the edge where the railing was. On the far right of the roof, the railing opened, extending itself into a narrow catwalk. This railing led to the metal steps, by which steps one descended into the courtyard. Once in this courtyard, which seemed to be closed in by walls, one might wonder what on earth to do. It was something of a trap. Still, one would not have had to leap from the burning building. Once on the ground, one had to hope, merely, not to be buried beneath the flaming, crashing walls.
Well, said Fonny,
carefully holding me by one elbow and leading me back onto the roof.
I can dig that.
We again went through the ritual of the locking of the doors and descended into the street.
Don't worry about the neighbors, Levy said, because after 5 or 6 o'clock, you won't have any. All you got between you and the street are small, failing sweatshops.
And we got into the streets and he showed us how to lock and unlock the street door.
Got it?
He asked Fonny.
Got it, Fonny said. Come on, I'll buy you a milkshake.
And we had 3 milkshakes on the corner, and Levy shook hands and left us, saying that he had to get home to his wife and kids, 2 boys, 1 age 2, 1 age 3.5. But before he left us, he said,
Look, I told you not to worry about the neighbors, but watch out for the cops. They're murder.
One of the most terrible, most mysterious things about a life is that a warning can be heeded only in retrospect. Too late. Levy left us, and Fonny and I walked hand in hand up the broad, bright, crowded streets toward the village, toward our pad. We talked and talked and laughed and laughed. We crossed Houston and started up 6th Avenue, Avenue of the Americas, with all those fucking flags on it, which we didn't see. I wanted to stop at one of the markets on Bleecker Street to buy some tomatoes. We crossed the Avenue of the Americas and started west on Bleecker. Fonny had one hand around my waist. We stopped at a vegetable stand. I started looking. Fonny hates shopping. He said, Wait 1 minute, I'm going to buy some cigarettes. And he went up the street just around the corner. I started picking out the tomatoes, and I remember that I was kind of humming to myself. I started looking around for a scale and for the man or the woman who would weigh the tomatoes for me and tell me what I owed. Fonny is right about me when he says I'm not very bright. When I first felt this hand on my behind, I thought it was Fonny. Then I realized that Fonny would never, never touch me that way in public. I turned my 6 tomatoes in both hands and found myself facing a small, young, greasy Italian punk.
I can sure dig a tomato who digs tomatoes, he said, and he licked his lips and smiled.
2 things happened in me all at the same time. 3. This was a very crowded street. I knew that Fonny would be back at any moment. I wanted to smash my tomatoes in the boy's face, but no one had really noticed us yet, and I didn't want Fonny to get into a fight. I saw a white cop coming slowly up the street. I realized that I was black and that the crowded streets were white. And so I turned away and walked into the shop, still with my tomatoes in my hands. I found a scale, and I put the tomatoes on the scale, and I looked around for someone to weigh them so that I could pay and get out of this store before Fonny came back from around the corner. The cop was now on the other side of the street, and the boy had followed me into the store.
Hey, sweet tomato, you know I dig tomatoes.
And now people were watching us. I did not know what to do. The only thing to do was to get out of there before Fonny turned the corner. I tried to move, but the boy blocked my way. I looked around for someone to help me. People were staring, but no one moved. I decided in despair to call the cop. But when I moved, the boy grabbed my arm. He was really probably just a broken down junkie. But when he grabbed my arm, I slapped his face and I spat in it. And exactly at that moment, Fonny entered the store. Fonny grabbed the boy by the hair, knocked him to the ground, picked him up and kicked him in the balls, and dragged him to the sidewalk and knocked him down again. I screamed and held on to Fonny with all my might, for I saw that the cop, who had been on the far corner, was now crossing the street on the run, and the white boy lay bleeding and retching in the gutter. I was sure that the cop intended to kill Fonny, but he could not kill Fonny if I could keep my body between Fonny and this cop. And with all my strength, with all my love, my prayers, and armed with the knowledge that Fonny was not, after all, going to knock me to the ground, I held the back of my head against Fonny's chest, held both his wrists between my 2 hands, and I looked up into the face of this cop. I said, "That man there attacked me right in this store, right now. Everybody saw it." No one said a word. The cop looked at them all. Then he looked back at me. Then he looked at Fonny. I could not see Fonny's face, but I could see the cop's face. And I knew that I must not move, nor, if I could possibly help it, allow Fonny to move.
"And where were you?"
the cop elaborately asked Fonny. "While all this..." His eyes flicked over me in exactly the same way the boy's eyes had.
"While all this was going on between Junior there and..."
His eyes took me in again. "And your girl." "He was around the corner," I said, "buying cigarettes." For I did not want Fonny to speak. I hoped that he would forgive me later.
"Is that so, boy?"
I said, "He's not a boy, officer." Now he looked at me, really looked at me for the first time, and therefore, for the first time, he really looked at Fonny. Meanwhile, some people had got Junior to his feet.
"You live around here?"
the cop asked Fonny. The back of my head was still on Fonny's chest, but he had released his wrists from my hands.
"Yes," Fonny said, "on Bank Street."
And he gave the officer the address. I knew that in a moment, Fonny would push me away.
"We're going to take you down, boy," the cop said, "for assault and battery."
I do not know what would now have happened if the Italian lady who ran the store had not spoken up.
"Oh, no," she said. "I know both these young people. They shop here very often. What the young lady has told you is the truth. I saw them both just now when they came, and I watched to choose her tomatoes, and her young man left her, and he said he would be right back. I was busy. I could not get to her right away. Her tomatoes are still on the scale, and that little good-for-nothing shit over there, he did attack her, and he has got exactly what he deserved. What would you do if a man attacked your wife, if you have one?"
The crowd snickered, and the cop flushed.
"I saw exactly what happened. I am a witness, and I will swear to it."
She and the cop stared at each other.
"Funny way to run a business,"
he said, and licked his lower lip.
"You will not tell me how to run my business," she said. "I was on this street before you got here, and I will be here when you are gone. Take," she said,
gesturing toward the boy now sitting on the curbstone with some of his friends around him.
"That miserable urchin away with you to Bellevue or to Rikers Island. Or drop him in the river. He is of no earthly use to anyone. But do not try to frighten me. Basta!"
I noticed for the first time that Bell's eyes are blue and that what I can see of his hair is red. He looks again at me and then again at Fonny. He licks his lips again. The Italian lady re-enters the store and takes my tomatoes off the scale and puts them in a bag.
"Well," says Belle, staring at Fonny. "Be seeing you around."
"You may," says Fonny.
"And then again, you may not."
"Not,"
says the Italian lady, coming back into the street.
"If they or I see you first."
She turns me around and puts the bag of tomatoes into my hands. She is standing between myself and Belle. She stares into my eyes.
"You have a good man," she says. "Take him home, away from these diseased pigs."
I look at her. She touches my face.
"I have been in America a long time," she says. "I hope I do not die here."
She goes back into her store. Fonny takes the tomatoes from me and holds the bag in the crook of one arm. The other arm he entwines through mine, interlocking his fingers through mine. We walked slowly away toward our pad.